In this first hour of Focus 580, we will revisit a topic that we've discussed on this program before, and that is the relationship between Iran and the United States. We will also talk a little bit about Iranian politics, specifically what's been going on in that country since elections were held earlier this year, where the conservatives scored a significant victory over reformers. And our guest for the program is Ahmad Sadri. He's professor of sociology and anthropology at Lake Forest College. And he is particularly interested in Iran and the Middle East, as well as the subject of reform in Islam and in Iran. He is the author of a number of books and many articles, many of them dealing with the Middle East. He is, in addition, columnist with the Daily Star of Lebanon. That's an insert in the Middle Eastern edition of the International Herald Tribune. And in addition to all that, does a lot of interviews, conversations on programs like this, talking about Iran and its politics. As we talk in this hour of the show, of course, questions are welcome. All we ask of people who call is that they try to keep their questions brief, just so we can keep the program moving, get in as many people as possible. But of course, people who are listening, they are welcome into the conversation. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. Also, though, we do have that toll-free line, and if it would be a long-distance call, if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or if you might be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, certainly you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Sadri, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us again.
I'm happy to be on your program again.
We talked in June of last year, and at least as far as the relations between the United States and Iran are concerned, I thought back to the kind of things that we were talking about when we had our last conversation, and it doesn't seem that things have changed very much, at least as far as the United States is concerned. There is still concerns about Iran and its nuclear program, something I'm sure we'll talk about. Also about the possibility that Iran, and again, in the mind of the Bush administration, might be involved in supporting terrorism. So it seems that certainly going back to the very beginnings of the Bush administration, there has been tension between the governments of the two countries. And today, it doesn't seem that things have changed very much.
Groundhog Day.
Let's talk about the what seems to be a major concern of the United States, and that is the nuclear program of Iran. The United States believes, apparently, that Iran is interested in producing nuclear weapons, and for its part, the government of Iran says that its intentions as far as its nuclear program is concerned are peaceful, and they're just interested in generating electricity. And there has been a lot of jockeying back and forth on this particular issue now for some time. What do we know about Iran's nuclear program?
Well, I think we should take the claims of both sides with a rather large lump of salt. There is a lot of jockeying back and forth, as I said, as you mentioned, and most of this is tinged with intentions for internal consumption, and of course there are a lot of real issues also that are floating in between ideological spin that is put on the issue. There is definitely a lot of hyperventilation about Iran recently in the United States regarding the links to Al-Qaeda, regarding the Iranian intentions about nuclear weapons, about stirring things up in Iraq. And I basically think that a lot of these are part of the an election year campaign. Of creating an issue and kind of challenging the Democrats to come up with either yay or nay and kind of locking them into some kind of a rhetorical impasse. There are real problems about the nuclear issues in Iran, but they are not the ones that are highlighted by the administration. We can go through them one by one. But basically speaking, the Bushehr reactor that Iran is developing is not a new program. It was commissioned and actually it was recommended to Iran 25 years ago, was originally encouraged by the Nixon administration. And the Americans encouraged the Shah of Iran to develop the nuclear facility in Bushehr. The only reason it didn't go online is that the revolutionaries in Iran foolishly decided that they wanted to go green and use the energy of God-given sources of sun and wind and water. So they decommissioned it, and they actually used the very expensively bought equipment for that facility for the sewers of the city of Bushehr. And so it didn't go online. And eventually, decades after, they decided to put it back together. And now, of course, it has become a major issue of as if Iran kind of has secretly developed this facility in order to generate a nuclear weapon. I mean, starting from there, you can see the distortions. I mean, this is something that is very rarely mentioned in news. Whenever it's mentioned, the impression is given that Iran is enriching uranium because Iran wants to develop a nuclear weapon in Bushehr.
Are there people within the government of Iran who would like to see the country become a nuclear power?
Absolutely. I mean, that is there is no question about this. Although Iran has a legitimate right to develop electricity and use atomic power peacefully, it would be foolhardy to deny that there is a desire by some people in Iran to develop nuclear weapons. That is common in the Middle East. Nuclear weapons bring prestige and create the kind of umbrella that that allows one an enormous amount of security from potential threats in the neighborhood. It is a dangerous neighborhood. We have four atomic powers in the neighborhood. We have Pakistan, we have India, we have Israel, we have Russia, and just remember the way in which Pakistanis are dealing with their nuclear power. They scoffed at the idea of an inspection by the United States, and they have valorized and made a hero out of their nuclear scientists, even when they are caught passing on selling nuclear information to other countries. This is a very, very dangerous situation in the region, and it needs very serious attention. I happen to be very much against nuclear weapons in the region, and I think everybody should stand down, and we should prevent countries who don't have nuclear weapons from developing them. But I also think that this cannot be done the way in which we are witnessing these days, that is, nuclear club members flexing their muscles and rattling their sabers and beating on the drums of their nuclear power, threatening everybody, and that, by the way, includes the United States. And then, at the same time, they argue that nuclear weapons are not a good thing to develop. That is a double message. If you are threatening other countries with nuclear weapons and saying, don't develop nuclear weapons, and if you don't listen to us, we are going to hit you with nuclear weapons, you are basically refuting your own gambit. So I think that this is a very serious issue. Unfortunately, it is muddled by ideological spin, and it is, in my view, what needs to be done in the region is very serious effort by nuclear club members. And by the way, I think it's very appropriately named. It's a club. You know, people who get in, they want to prevent others from entering. They should really stand down. They should show a good faith effort to limit, to reduce their nuclear weapons. At the same time, then they will have the credibility to ask others not to develop them. Unfortunately, the way it is being conducted these days, it is very counterproductive. It creates a mechanism that other countries who don't have nuclear weapons would want to seek them in secret, exactly the way in which Pakistan has. And the absurdities of this is so apparent. You remember when Pakistan was shedding crocodile tears in the Security Council about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, whereas they themselves developed weapons of mass destruction exactly in the manner that Iraqis were trying to develop them. So I think we should people in the Middle East, and I think people on this planet, should be very, very concerned about development of nuclear weapons anywhere, especially in the Middle East, with this very precarious environment. But unfortunately, the way it is being politicized is not helpful.
Our guest, just to reintroduce, is Professor Ahmad Sadri. He's professor of sociology and anthropology at Lake Forest College, which is in Lake Forest, Illinois. And among his interests, Iran and the Middle East. And here we're talking about the current state of relations between Iran and the United States. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Not very long ago, one of the big items in the news, one of the things coming out of the commission investigating the terrorist attacks of September 11th, was apparently the finding that some of the people who were involved in that attack had passed through Iran. And although the commission did not, and I think we need to be very clear, and I think the commission was clear, did not suggest that Iran, the government of Iran, had any role in the attacks of September 11th. I think the commission was pretty strong on that. The administration was a little bit, they were saying, well, we need to find out what might be behind this. But I think the commission said, no, we don't think the government was involved. At the same time, there were some questions about why it is that people who apparently were involved in al-Qaeda found it so easy to pass through Iran. And again, it would tend to reinforce the position that the United States has staked out, is that there has been some involvement of Iran in terrorism. So how do we sort all this out?
Well, I think that this is another one of those issues that that was extremely, at least in my view, transparent. Once the 9/11 Commission report made the connection, the administration and its spokesman and the new conservative pundits would pounce on it and repeat the issue until it almost became a kind of certainty in public mind that Iran had something to do with the 9/11 atrocities. Well, what is the accusation? Some al-Qaeda members have passed through Iran. Their passports are not stamped. If they were stamped, Iran would be culpable because Iran allowed them to pass. And now that they are not stamped, we don't know why they are not stamped. Did they slip in and out of these countries as they do with other countries, including the United States? There is one piece of evidence, information coming from a person in Guantanamo Bay, an al-Qaeda member, who has every right to drag Iran into this situation because of the theological disagreements between the Salafi and Wahhabi extremist Sunni fundamentalists and the Iranian Shiite fundamentalists. So that information kind of implies that Iranians intentionally did not stamp these passports. But look at the map. Is it possible for al-Qaeda members to go from Afghanistan to Iran directly to the United States? Didn't they pass through other countries? What other countries did or did not stamp these passports? It really shows the way in which Iran is being dragged into this and fingered in this manner in order to kind of create a platform for accusations. Mm-hmm. Now, just one more issue that I want to mention. It doesn't really make any common sense for Iran and al-Qaeda to be in bed together. Iran and al-Qaeda, before the invasion of Afghanistan, al-Qaeda and Taliban's most vociferous and sworn enemy in the world was Iran. The head of the two countries, the Taliban's Mullah Muhammad Omar and Iran's Ayatollah Khamenei, excommunicated each other. They called each other non-Muslims. And basically, for all intents and purposes, put fatwas on each other because they absolutely detest each other because their brand of fundamentalism appears to be an apostasy to the other party. The Taliban, as well as the al-Qaeda, consider the Shiites to be apostate Muslims, and they have engaged in massacres of Shiites in Afghanistan. They have killed in Mazar-e-Sharif 9 Iranian diplomats. So Iran and the Taliban and their allies, the Al-Qaeda, came to blows. Almost there was a frontal war on the borders of these two countries. So the suggestion that Iran is secretly helping Al-Qaeda doesn't make any common sense to me, unless I am shown credible evidence that this is occurring. I am very skeptical about these allegations, and they really don't make any sense to me.
So when President Bush says, as he has said, that Iran is harboring Al-Qaeda leadership, and that's a quote, that you would say that, well, it's possible that there might be Al-Qaeda people in Iran, that there wouldn't, that the government in a formal sort of way would not be sheltering the leadership of Al-Qaeda.
Well, I would add a footnote there. Yes, there are, in all probability, Al-Qaeda operatives in detention in Iran. Iran has captured several members of the Al-Qaeda, and they have returned some of them to their countries of origin, mostly to Saudi Arabia. Others they are keeping, but they are keeping them as bargaining chips in order to negotiate with Americans. As you know, all the claims of fighting terrorism, notwithstanding, American government in Iraq is sheltering and giving succor to a terrorist group, and I say terrorist because they are designated as a terrorist group by the United States, in Iraq, and this is a terrorist group called Mujahideen, and it is the armed opposition against the government of Iran. Well, Iranians have been hoping to exchange some of these Al-Qaeda members for favors, similar favors, against the organization of Mujahideen in Iraq. So, yeah, there are some Al-Qaeda members in Iran, but they are not operatives. They are not calling in attacks if Iran has them in custody. It is also possible that some of these people are loose. It's very possible because the border with Afghanistan is extremely porous, and Iran has not been able even to put a dent in the drug trafficking, let alone the trafficking of terrorists. Yes, there are some operatives in Iran, some that are not caught, they are loose, Iran cannot control them, and some that are in custody, and Iran wants to use them as bargaining chips.
Another of the concerns of the United States is the potential that Iran would have to become involved in politics in Iraq, and it's interesting to look at this because I think it's much more complicated than on the surface it would look, because on the one hand we do have the I guess you would think it would be reasonable for there to be some affinity between the two countries, at least in as much as in Iran, these people are all Shia, and there are an awful lot of Shiis in Iraq. At the same time, you don't have to look back too far to find the time when Iraq and Iran fought a war against one another and killed a lot of each other's citizens. So that you can, on the one hand, see some reason that there might be connections, and on the other hand, reason that you might be seeing a lot of bad blood. So then comes down to the question, well, what are Iran's interests in Iraq? And then maybe separate from them, what sort of possibility does Iran have to actually have some influence in Iraq?
Well, one could say that Iran does have legitimate interests in Iraq. The sites of religious pilgrimage for Shiites, all the major ones, with the exception of one, are in Iraq. And so there is a great deal of interest in pilgrimage, almost non-rational interest. As soon as the Saddam Hussein fell, within days there were busloads of Iranian pilgrims who were streaming into these pilgrimage sites. So of course there is a great number of Shiites a majority Shiite in Iraq that have been deprived of their constitutional rights under a Sunni-dominated regime. Under the Baath Party, so Iran would have some interest in Iraq. But It is much more complicated than that, as you mentioned. Let's take the case of Iran-Iraq war. In the Iran-Iraq war, Iraqis mistakenly thought that the Iranian ethnic Arabs would welcome them once they come into Iran, into the Khuzestan area. This never happened, and actually Arabs resisted their fellow Arab brethren, and this never happened. Iran also naively thought that Iraqi Shiites would welcome its advances into Iraq, and this never happened. Shiites also, along with their Sunni compatriots, fought against Iranians. So that is one wrinkle. Nationality in the Iran-Iraq war trumped religious affiliation among Shiites. And the second issue to consider is that the theological debates in Iran and in Iraq divide Shiites to two camps. In both countries, there is a quietist interpretation, traditionalist interpretation of Shiite polity that basically admonishes all Shiites to eschew politics and await the coming of the final Messiah, for coming of the last Imam. There is a new kind of modern interpretation of Shiite theology, spearheaded by Khomeini and adhered to by a minority of theologians, and that argues for establishment of an Islamic government. This apparently, this second school of thought won in Iran and became hardened into the theocracy that we see in Iran today. In Iraq, however, the quietist traditionalist interpretation has prevailed, and this is the one that is adhered to by the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, arguably the most important Shiite leader in the world. Now, Muqtada Sadr follows the more militant approach, and he doesn't have any religious credentials as an Ayatollah. So the politics really divides the Shiites in Iraq, first on the basis of whether or not they should enter politics to advocate for a theocracy, and second, the Shiites in Iraq have a great nationalist issue against Shiites of Iranian origin in Iraq. So Muqtada Sadr belongs to the nationalist Shiites who say Shiites of Iranian origin in Iraq have been controlling too much. And so on those two bases, the cooperation between Iraq, between Muqtada Sadr, the militant Shiites in Iraq, and Iranians is a very, very complicated issue. Iranians, in my view, have not had a direct role in the uprising in the city of Najaf. It is possible that some Iranians are caught fighting there, but it is very unlikely that any of these are blessed by the government. You can have, individuals who go on their own initiative to join fights in foreign countries. We had that in international brigades in Spain. Lord Byron went to Greece to fight in Greek independence, but it didn't mean necessarily that those governments supported these.
Well, what do you think that in the long term Iran would like to see happen in Iraq, aside from the fact that I would assume they would like to see the United States military force there leave?
Well, ironically, Iranians have a great stake in territorial unity of Iraq. And that's another reason Iranians would not want to foment too much trouble. They may want to make life miserable for Americans, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And that's a great reason for the American government to come to some kind of an understanding with Iranians, as is suggested by the Special Committee in Center for Foreign Relations, headed by Mr. Brzezinski, that suggests that Americans should come to a kind of modus vivendi with Iranians because things are getting out of hand in both Afghanistan and in Iraq. So Iranians might not be too unhappy if Americans have their hands full in in Iraq. But Iranians don't have any interest in seeing an independent Shiite state in Iraq. I mean, born from the side of Iraq, because that would mean an independent Kurdish state in the north. That would be very destabilizing for Iranian Kurdish population, and it would be very destabilizing, very threatening for Iran. So Iran has a great deal of interest in Iraq's territorial integrity, although Iranian administration, the right-wingers who are firmly in power, as you mentioned earlier, they would not be too unhappy to see Americans suffer and bleed in Iraq.
We are a little bit past the midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Professor Ahmad Sadri. He's professor of sociology and anthropology at Lake Forest College in Lake Forest, Illinois, and is particularly interested in Iran and the Middle East and also reform in Islam and Iran. He's authored a number of books and articles, and in addition, he is also columnist with the Daily Star of Lebanon. That's an insert in the Middle Eastern edition of the International Herald Tribune. And he's talking with us this morning about Iran, its politics, relations between Iran and the United States. And the questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, as we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois or Indiana, 800-222-9455. Well, as we talk, as I just mentioned very, very briefly earlier, and I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk in a little bit greater detail. There were elections held in Iran earlier this year, and in those elections, the conservatives scored very significant gains, and a lot of people were asking the question rhetorically, whither the cause of reform now for Iran? Maybe first we just might talk a little bit about what happened and why it is that it seemed that those who represent the conservative side of politics in Iran did so well in these elections.
Well, they cheated. That's how. The reform came into power in 1997 as a result of a massive disenchantment with the government of God, fueled mostly by the disappointing end of the Iran-Iraq War. I would like to get into this later also, mm-hmm. about the possibility of a second disenchantment if the present administration in Iran enters into negotiation with Americans. It would have to be a public acceptance of the United States, and I say this because it will have a similar impact on Iranians who have heard the rhetoric, the anti-American rhetoric of these same right-wingers for so many years. The acceptance of the ceasefire with Iraqis, despite all the hot-headed rhetoric by Ayatollah Khomeini, fueled a great deal of disenchantment among Iranian young revolutionaries, and in about a decade, it led to the reform movement, and the reform movement's political face was Mr. Khatami. Khatami came to power, but unfortunately, he turned out to be a very pusillanimous and weak leader, and he was not able to play hardball with the right wingers. And the right wingers played every dirty trick in the book to stymie, to prevent Khatami and the reform movement from going ahead. And Khatami was not able to take them on. The reformers, therefore, lost the confidence of people who had voted for them in four consecutive landslide elections. And finally, people stayed away from their polls. And the reformers, claiming their regular 15% support, won the parliament, and they're likely to win the presidential elections next year, and there is a great deal of dismay and despair in Iran among Iranian reformists, and what will happen to the future of reform in Iran is very, very uncertain. I just came back from Iran last month, and I participated as a member of the Iranian reform movement in many of the meetings, and there is a great deal of uncertainty about the future of reform in Iran. In the near future, the right wing is going to have the power, And that is a reality that, again, Mr. Brzezinski and the practical wing of American politicians are recognizing. The government of Iran is not going anywhere. The right-wingers are in power. And Americans might as well recognize that and start negotiating with the Iranian right-wingers. This is not palatable to either Iranian reformers who wished this kind of revision would have occurred at the beginning of Khatami's term. It is not palatable to American new conservatives and ideological anti-Iranian factions in the United States. But I agree with Brzezinski that that is a practical step to be taken next. Iran, the right-wing government of Iran and the United States should enter into public and formal negotiations, because things in the Middle East don't seem to be changing very fast in Iran. Hmm.
Well, you talked about the fact that Mr. Khatami has not been a particularly effective leader, or at least that he wasn't able to prevail against the conservatives and in getting done what he wanted to get done. And perhaps for that reason, many Iranians have turned against reform because the promises were unfulfilled. On the other hand, given the kind of strength that the conservatives have, and the fact that, as you say, they've done everything that they could to strengthen their position, including, for example, in the run-up to the recent election, having a lot of reform candidates simply tossed off the ballot, given all of that, could anyone have done better than Mr. Khatami did, or do you think it is particularly the case that he's just just not strong enough personally somehow to change things?
That second one, I think Khatami was a phenomenally, spectacularly ineffective leader. He did not have the His public ethos basically is not fit for public office. He kind of brings a personal ethos of kindliness to everyone and avoiding to be hated by anyone to public office. And you cannot lead a reform movement in Iran trying not to anger anybody. And he was particularly, in my view, very cowardly in his confrontations with the right wing. He is a great disappointment. Now, counterfactual, is it possible that somebody else would have done better? I have no doubt that it would have been possible if Khatami had risen to the occasion. And if he had realized that he has a historical opportunity to change things in Iran, there was a lot that he could have done. He couldn't have done everything, but given the mandate that he had, his legal powers were very limited. But the public mandate that he had was completely squandered. He refused to be innovative. He refused to be proactive. And he refused to respond to the challenges of the right wing in a creative way. And he basically seemed to be running the clock. But he was not ahead in the game. He was behind in the game. He's still behind. So, somebody else in Khatami's shoes would have done a better job. Still, it might not have come to anything, but because right-wing might have pulled the coup d'etat or done other dirty tricks that they didn't, they haven't in this case, because they didn't need to. But I have no doubt that an able political leader would have performed much better.
We have a couple of callers to talk with. Let's talk with someone in Charleston. Yeah, they're first in line, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I'll try to keep this simple. Given the long history of Arabic peoples and the Middle East and their social organization until British colonialism in would have been the 18th, 19th century, and then American colonialism in the 20th, and that going on this very day, Iraq, you know, for all that means. And would we be having this conversation or the subject matter about the Middle East if there were no oil. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, Professor Zadri, respond to that in whatever way you like.
Well, that's also an interesting counterfactual, and sociologists and historians like to entertain counterfactuals, and I think it is constructive to think about what would have happened if, let's say, oil had been absent from the equation. I think yes, one could say that we would still have. I mean, I would say that we would have a lot of these same discussions, but not with the same intensity. Oil is very important, but I'm afraid some people are making too much of oil. For instance, the invasion of Iraq, in view of many of the American liberals, goes back to the issue of money and oil. I disagree with that. I think it was an ideological move. It was, of course, there are profiteers, war profiteers, starting with Halliburton and oil men, and everybody wants to get a piece of the cake. Once a war is going, war profiteering is a given. But oil war did not fuel this invasion. Ideology did. American national interests had nothing to do with the invasion of Iraq, but the inclinations of a very small group of new conservatives to remake the map of the Middle East had everything to do with it. Oil in these countries have been, for the most part, more of a damnation than a blessing. It has prevented governments that rely on taxes, which means governments that need the consent of the ruled, governments basically have been rentier, have relied on oil rather than having to rely on the consent of the populations that they rule. And oil has fueled, to the extent that it was not plundered by colonialist powers, it has fueled ambition, like the ambitions of the late Shah of Iran, and it has created greed and prevented the development of a healthy bourgeois capitalist economy in these countries, a healthy middle class. So, in a way, things would have been very different. And if I had my way, I would have no oil in my country. And I've heard the same desire on the part of other intellectuals in the Arab world.
All right, let's continue. We have another caller here listening in Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Two general questions. One, I'd like for you to speak about the students. What little news we do get here from Iran, I remember reading the papers about there was some, I wouldn't guess we call it rioting, but certainly out into the streets of reformist-minded students. I wondered what part they're going to play in the future. And secondly, I'd like for you to give a general view of what's going to happen if the neocons are still in power in the next 4 years in this country. Thank you.
All right.
Two questions. Students and the prospects of neocons in power for the next election. The students played a very heroic role in the reform movement. The reformists, rather than the President Khatami, the reformists are at fault for not recognizing the role of students. The students went out there basically with nothing but their bodies trying to advocate reform and claim their rights. And the reformist politicians ignored them and allowed them to languish in jail, did not react properly to their brutalization by the goons of the right-wing government. So the reformers basically are at fault for not supporting the students enough. The students, in reaction, are extremely disheartened. They have turned away from politics, and they are extremely disgusted with the reformers because they have they feel that they are abandoned, and rightly so. The students are turning also away in a most radical way in Iran from religion and from religious politics, and they are radical, the majority of them, I can judge from my lectures in universities in Iran that I usually deliver on a yearly basis. They are extremely secularist, and they are turning away from politics towards a kind of almost Epicurean self-interest. And this is mostly the Council of Despair rather than a kind of conscious political decision. If new cars are in power, what will happen? Again, we have heard all the drumbeat of war and the chant of real men go to Iran. We all know, however, that with the way we are overstretched in the Middle East, this is just foolish talk. Americans are not going to invade Iran. Even surgical attacks are, in my view, unlikely. We have great concerns in the Middle East. One of the most important and most dangerous spots in the Middle East is Pakistan, with its nuclear weapons, with its considerable fundamentalist inclinations in the population, which is missing in Iran. Iran is the only country in the Middle East that doesn't have a grassroots fundamentalist movement, and fundamentalism is only the issue of the higher echelons of the right-wing government. So if neocons come to power, it's unlikely that they would invade Iran. They are going to basically isolate Iran, which is also a very self-defeating policy, because we don't have enough allies who are going to participate in this isolation. You can't isolate another country only if you are by yourself, and this Bush unilateralism is not favorable to a policy of isolation. And so I think if neocons come to power, more of the same will follow. There's going to be vilification of Iran in America to correspond to the vilification of America in Iran. In both cases, this vilification is for internal consumption rather than serving any real national interest of either of the two countries.
We touched a little earlier on the fact that there are at least some people within Washington that would like to see an effort made to improve and have a more normal kind of relationship with Iran.
I think that is the view that will prevail if Kerry wins. I think if Kerry wins, there will be a practical approach to negotiations with Iran. But I would urge that if such negotiations occur, they should be public. They should force the Iranian right-wingers to come out rather than engage in under-the-table negotiations that we saw, unfortunately, in the Iran-Contra affair, which is what they are used to, the kind of bizarre bargaining and haggling over small piecemeal issues. It should be basically a piecemeal solution, but if Americans under the Kerry administration are going to open a direct line of negotiation with Iran, they should force the Iranian right-wingers to come out and accept that they are engaged in such conversations, and by implication they have to pay the price in the slogans that they have been touting for the last 25 years, indicating again that the politics of radicalism is dead end and delivering a self-inflicted blow to their own ideological edifice.
Well, that presents the government of Iran with some interesting and difficult choices, whether or not they want to do something that might be in their interest in the long run, and in fact might be supported by significant numbers of Iranian people. I don't know, but at the same time, they would have to say, "Well, what we had said before, we changed our minds," and which they might not want to do. It doesn't really look like it gives the government of Iran much room to move one way or the other.
No, it would. Iran has a lot to gain from normalization of relations with the United States. And the United States has quite a deal to gain from it. The United States will gain in a more stable Iraq, a more stable Afghanistan, and a more predictable Middle East, a real commitment from Iran to reduce its nuclear ambitions. And Iran will gain a lot also, because Iran also has very real security issues in the Middle East. Iran has a great fear of tensions with neighbors. The tensions with Iraq are rising again, as we have noticed, almost to the level of the tensions that existed between Iran and Iraq before the Iran-Iraq war. The Pakistan is a mighty enemy on the east. The Pakistanis helped the Taliban come to power, the bête noire of Iranians. Iranians have a great deal to gain from normalization, and normalization is extremely popular with Iranian population. So the right-wingers, if they spearhead normalization, they will also become very popular. So both sides have a lot to gain. And the only caution, as I mentioned, is that it should be a public and formal move rather than a secret and behind-the-scenes negotiation. Mm.
We have a couple minutes left. We do have another caller. We'll get them in here, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I have two things. One sort of a historical a question, but since you were just talking about the dangers of the neighborhood, I've never done this before, but I wanted to mention that there's an hour-long interview with Mordechai Vanunu on the program Democracy Now!, which airs in this market. 90.1 at 4 o'clock, and is available on the web in a variety of ways, and it's well worth hearing, I think, because he's the fellow that exposed the open secret of Israel's huge arsenal as opposed to 8 or 12 weapons.
And you're talking about nuclear weapons?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's still a political prisoner in a way. He served 18 years, and it's a very interesting story. But going on, the Iranian Revolution, the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War, as you pointed out, the secularity of the youth in Iran and even elders. We have in this country, I think, a very one-dimensional view of the Iranian Revolution, and don't sort of remember that Bani Sadr, a very secular man, was first prime minister, and that that was a large dimension of it. In fact, one can make the argument that the U.S. role in the area, realpolitik, arming both sides of the Iran-Iraq war, secret diplomacy, et cetera, actually helped push things to the fundamentalists. I'm not going to speculate on unintended or intended consequences, but it could be just blowback since there's so much of that. But I wanted you to respond to those two points, and the idea of the roots of the Iranian Revolution would be something I think would be salutary for Americans to hear.
And I can,
if indeed you agree, and you have only a couple moments, right?
That's right. I can give you a couple minutes, Professor Sadr. Please do go ahead.
A very informed comment by the caller. The issue of blowback is definitely true. The mismanagement of the foreign policy of the United States in ways more than one contributed to the revolution in Iran, and the way in which the United States acted also after that did contribute to the worsening of the situation and the radicalization of the politics in Iran. But I would say that most of these issues, especially the radicalization of politics in Iran, had internal causes rather than external causes. There was a great deal of secular interest at the outset of the Iranian Revolution, but the dynamics of the revolution, the radical demands of some secularist groups, led to a kind of radicalization and takeover of the right wing in the Iranian politics. The important issue at this point is what the future will bring Iran, and how the United States can help the movement of Iran towards democracy. And I would say that opening up of negotiations, even with the right-wing government, as happened in Eastern Europe, would be helpful in indirect ways. If it is open and public, it will open up more possibilities for Iranian reformers. Any talk of invasion is basically loose talk, unproductive, and plays into the hands of the right wing the way the caller pointed out.
Well, there we will have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Ahmad Sadri. He's professor of sociology and also anthropology at Lake Forest College in Lake Forest, Illinois. He's also columnist with the Daily Star of Lebanon, an insert in the Middle Eastern edition of the International Herald Tribune. Professor Sadri, thank you once again for being with us today. We appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, David. Thank you.